Bugs, and I know you are missing tonight Eva Herr, but she is a bit under the weather, and so I am on very short notice standing in for her and picking up here to interview for her Tom DeLone, who we have tonight on the show. And I've had just a brief introduction to Tom, so I want to go ahead and say how are you? How you doing, Tom?
Oh, right. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Eva, as all of you know who are listeners to her, is the author of Agape, the book Agape, and which has gotten to be rather well known here. It's got a subtitle, but anyway, we have had this series of interviews going on now for quite some time, and talking to various interesting people who are doing cutting-edge things out there, and certainly cutting-edge thinking. And Tom, why don't you give us a little background on what you're doing these days?
Well, I just gave a lecture on future energy yesterday to a local group on Search for Common Ground, and it's in the Washington, D.C. area. And our institute, called Integrity Research Institute, is dedicated to energy research and education. And so we publish papers, books, videos, DVDs, and we have a conference on future energy coming up in the fall in September, September 22nd to 24th in the D.C. area, looking at and inviting speakers for a two-and-a-half-day event on emerging energy technologies that will replace fossil fuels.
Oh, that's really a really great timing, because this is really an appropriate area for us to really be putting a lot more attention these days. Is there a website for your organization?
Yes. The easiest one is the domain integrityresearchinstitute.org.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. I have personally not had a chance to go there, but I certainly will. But we have a lot in common here in this whole notion of advanced energy and something that I've been involved with off and on for quite some time, and you have too, obviously. And I thought tonight we could talk about the various projects that you think are perhaps the most, should we say, the most imminent here in terms of some realizing some economic return from them actually coming into existence, let's say, in the next 10 years. What would you put at the top of your list of the new energies?
Oh, on the top of the list?
Yeah.
The solar and wind and geothermal are wonderful projects that we can look at for the short term. And if you're concerned about just the next 10 years, then certainly we have to give them the most, I would say, the highest billing for breakthroughs that will certainly make a difference in that short term. If we're prepared to go to the 2020 mark, which is where colleagues of mine have targeted to really have on the market new replacement technologies that are clean, efficient, run by themselves, and don't require outside energy input at all, then we can look at a series of different types of technologies. One of my favorite is the magnetostatic motors.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel the research in that area, which our institute has helped, is actually quite promising.
Yes, I agree, and I thought we would certainly want to delve into that a little bit as we go along here. Just in the way of background here, my understanding of the situation now with fossil fuels is, I know there is some controversy out there, different opinions about how much do we have left and how accessible is it and how economic is it to recover, such as tar sands and so forth. But in terms of the in-ground recoverable oil, it does seem to me, based on the best evidence I've found, is that we're fairly quickly approaching the peak on that, Hubbert's peak. Is that your general understanding of it?
Absolutely. In fact, most, you'd say, at least half the scientists you interview will say the peak has already been reached, and the other half will say, well, 2010 is perhaps the longest that you can see extending that generalized peak before it starts to really be noticeably declining.
Yes, yes, right. Of course, I think we understand that it simply means that when you hit that peak, you don't suddenly run out of oil. You can't increase production anymore at that point, at least from the standpoint.
Well, actually, it's good that you mentioned that, Roy, because in my presentation yesterday, I cited Dr. Gately from New York University, and he gave an analysis of exactly the point you just were referring to at the Department of Energy's annual energy outlook just a couple of years ago. And, you know, the increased output that you're just referring to is something the public doesn't even know that OPEC has never done. In fact, I'm looking at the graph right now, and this is part of the slide presentation that Dr. Gately presented. But for all the years OPEC has ever been in existence, they've never exceeded 30 million barrels per day.
Is that right? The total OPEC output, is that
correct? That's right. And in fact, with his analysis proved with spreadsheets that even if they doubled the output, which is what the Department of Energy and the International Energy Agency has been predicting for years, until they replaced the director of the Energy Information Administration, the doubling of OPEC's output will never happen. And he explained why, because their profits will never be higher if they did so. So it's against their interest to increase their output.
Yes, right. There's no question about the economic games being played along with the political games.
That's right. We have to be really resigned to the fact that gasoline prices will continue to rise, heating oil prices will continue to rise. We have to get serious about alternatives. And Al Gore's new movie will make it even more compelling when people learn about the truth about global warming as well. ClimateCrisis.org is the preview, if anyone wants to see the trailer, of Al Gore's new movie.
When is that movie due out?
And May 24th, just another week away. So
really?
2 weeks away.
Yeah.
ClimateCrisis.org. It's a good website.
Well, you know, it's like anything else. Political visibility has to come into play before the people, particularly in the United States, ever get serious about something like this. And I know a lot of people, very frankly, who are concerned about a catastrophe potential with respect to energy. I don't really see that happening, but I think that what we're in now is, it would appear to me that we're in a transition phase where we've got to begin to move in these other directions and do it seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, sure. The short-term prospects that you're talking about, such as wind and solar, and I suppose nuclear probably is going to come into play here, too, if it doesn't get politically shot down, but I don't know whether that's going to be, whether the environmental politics is going to allow that or not. So,
The experts tend to say that nuclear will tend to be level. It's not really destined to increase for political reasons, even worldwide. Even in this country, there are barriers, although I've been to Department of Energy meetings where utility directors are exploring nuclear options.
Right.
For reactors, but the waste process needs to be finalized, and that's where our institute comes in, because we've actually been promoting the nuclear waste remediation process. And I can go on to more details if you're interested.
I'll tell you, the more interesting things to me, because my whole career has been in research, and the more interesting things to me are the ones out there on the edge, because that's where the long-term payoff is.
That's where my interest is, too.
Yeah, right. Now, coal fusion, that's an area that you're interested in as well, isn't it?
Yes, we even sponsored a low-energy nuclear reactions energy workshop. We called it LENRU back in 2000. And I know most of the major players in that field, and it's been very difficult for them since the Patent Office refuses to grant any patents in that area.
Yeah, that's true. I remember well back in, I believe it was, 86, when Fleisch and Ponce came out with their pronouncements. I happened to be at that time, I was at the Georgia Tech Research Institute, And in fact, the fellow in the office next to me was charged by the president of Georgia Tech with jumping on that thing, and it was prematurely done, as you remember.
Sure.
MIT and Georgia Tech jumped on it frantically at that time, and the results were negative, and the fellow who was doing the work really was very reticent to do it on such short notice and without such, you know, with so little preparation, and suddenly expectations were very high, and it got political. And there were little matters like, you know, if you don't have your neutron counter properly thermally compensated, you're going to get bad results, and that's what happened also at MIT. And so the whole thing got discredited, I think, unfortunately.
Yeah, but dwelling in the past really doesn't help the movement or the science. And
no.
I even saw the same type of discussion at the American Physical Society just a month ago here in D.C., you know, the review of the history.
Yeah, right.
People would rather hear about the latest results.
Yeah.
And the developments in the field.
Well, my general understanding, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I do know that the Japanese have, as typical of the Japanese, very patient. They've continued to work with this cold fusion over the years quietly, and they've been getting consistent positive results, I believe, if I understand correctly. But it seems that there is a definite limit to the outputs that you can get in terms of return of energy. Is that correct? Is it still the case?
Actually, I wouldn't say there's any limit. In fact, you might as well know, I write a column for Infinite Energy magazine. I don't know if you subscribe or have seen that magazine, but if people want to see the website, it's infinite-energy.com. But the point is that this month's column, I report on a story that I learned from the Department of Energy, and that is that there's now a new program with DARPA, the Research and Development Wing of the Defense Department, to research a cold fusion bomb.
Uh-huh.
So the limit of energy is not there. In fact, it's just the opposite. Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, explored back in 1989, May of 1989, right after the weekend that they announced the Pons and Fleischmann experiment, when Fleischmann was on his way back to England, and he told us, I heard this right from his mouth, it was what he called a spook story.
Uh-huh.
Edward Teller called him in his hotel room in San Francisco when he had a layover that he didn't expect.
Uh-huh.
So how Edward Teller refound him as he's entering his hotel room was another interesting part of the story. But the first question was, can you make a bomb from cold fusion?
Huh.
And the answer to that seems to be yes, because there's been at least three explosions with high-pressure cold fusion.
Oh.
And if anyone's seen the movie Chain Reaction, that's playing up the actual experience, the reality of the situation, of course.
Now where did that happen? Was that in Japan?
It's been in this country. Two of them in this country, and the third one is undisclosed.
I see. Oh, well, that's certainly news to me. And I haven't kept up, and I don't know how many people in the audience have kept up to date with what's been happening in that area. But I've always thought that... my general impression was that first of all, I think from the scientific point of view, there's been so much controversy about how in the world cold fusion could happen, that it represents a quantum phenomenon that we simply don't understand.
I wouldn't even say that anymore.
Yeah,
if you listen to any of the scientists, they will tell you exactly how they understand it. And I was privileged to sit for 2 hours with Scott Chubb at my reinstatement hearing at the patent office. And he explained it very simply, that you could garden variety helium from the experiments.
Uh-huh.
And overcoming the Coulomb barrier is really the only thing that has been explained now to allay the skeptics. So, years ago, you could actually get away with that excuse. It's not understood, and certainly it's a chemical electrolysis experiment, so it can't have any effect on nuclear things. But today's physicists have done a really good job in really smoothing out that theory part of it.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. So, yeah, I know at the outset, of course, that you know, it was one priesthood interfering with another priesthood, and that's a no-no. And that was the reason why the electrochemists were dismissed in the whole area.
Sure.
But it's typical, you know, once the physicists get up to speed, then they'll take ownership of it and go with it, which is fine. That's, I suppose, the way it's supposed to be.
Are you familiar with one of the new books on the topic? We might as well give credit to an author who's just recently published a new book on the rebirth of cold fusion. It's Stephen Krivet, published by Pacific Oaks Press, Los Angeles. And subtitled Real Science, Real Hope, and Real Energy, forward by Arthur C. Clarke.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. I'm just, as a matter of fact, writing that down as we talk here.
Yeah, Rebirth of Cold Fusion.
Yeah.
So it's wonderful to see. In fact, newenergytimes.com is a website that features the information on the book.
Yes, yes.
So I just received a review copy just about a month ago, so that's why I'm now aware of this.
Yeah.
And I met Steve at the American Physical Society meeting.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we, to get back to this whole question of how we, you know, the options that we have out there, and I want to get to the really interesting ones here in a moment.
Yeah.
But given all the options that we have, it seems to me that the challenge for society is to determine some economic way of transitioning out of where we are now into where we have to go. And,
right.
and it would appear to me, as just a matter of common sense, that probably there are some transition technologies that will play a significant part as we roll over towards this target that you're calling around 2020. And I hope that we can do it by 2020. That'd be great.
We have to.
That's really only 14 years. That's not that far, actually.
No.
So, you know, obviously over that period of time, some transition technologies will come into play. And I had just thought that there was perhaps a chance that cold fusion could be moving forward rapidly enough that it could play a part in this. And is that your thinking about it now? Would it be in the short, or, you know, 10-year period or something like that?
I wouldn't suggest that cold fusion has a chance to do that. If you're looking for exactly that, the transition technologies, getting to market quickly so that the next 10 years can be smoothed out. Really, you have to look at cold fusion in the bag of the emerging energy technologies that really require a good decade to get perfected and developed.
Okay.
See, R&D, I've worked in R&D departments, so I really have to mention this to clarify it for the listeners. R&D consists of research and development.
Right.
And to tell you the truth, cold fusion's in the research stage.
It's still in, yeah, right.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
So you have to complete that stage so that the prototype is working. And I'm actually working closely with at least two different cold fusion scientists who are very prominent. And I'm convincing them that, hey, we need to move into the development stage.
Yeah.
So get your prototype working and keep it together and make sure that you can prove it runs for a month by itself.
Yes,
you know?
Right.
And then we're in the stage where then we can say, yeah, within 10 years, within 5 to 10 years, we'll have something on the market. And that's the story. But let me, can I interject one other thing for
sure.
A transition technology?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And this is very conventional. Most people don't even think about it. But the concept of efficiency is now playing a big part in the Alliance to Save Energy, for example. If you go to ASE.org,
uh-huh.
ASE.org is just devoted to efficiency improvements in every avenue of energy usage. And Rocky Mountain Institute, Amory Lovins Institute, is devoted to proving that in the short term, the next decade, energy efficiency improvements can literally cut in half our imports of oil and every other usage of energy across the board.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's
definitely a lot of
room for improvement there.
Yeah, and it has diminishing returns. You know, we need to be aware of the fact it's not going to keep getting better and better all the time.
Right.
But in the short term, the efficiency improvements have proven over and over again to be a way that the public can respond right away.
Yeah.
And they did it during the 70s oil crisis.
Yes,
and we're
starting
to do it again now when the pumps are starting to squeeze our pocketbook.
I don't think there's any doubt that if if the automotive companies will get serious about this, they can do a whole lot to help us in that area.
Yeah, and we can too. We can take one day to do public transportation a week.
Yeah.
You know, and I have the choice when I go to work, and I'm sure many other people might have that choice too.
Well, you know, and there are technologies that can help that too. I mean, I think we're getting very close to the point where the materials research now seems to be indicating that we can get fairly close to room temperature superconduction.
That's absolutely true.
Yep.
And in fact, that's another technology the patent office has banned from being allowing patent coverage on.
Uh-huh.
So you're absolutely right that that's a technology that needs to be implemented in the market.
Right, right.
Scientists have already proven that they have the prototypes to work.
Well, of course, you know, the point of view taken about this whole thing by economists, it seems, is that you don't worry about it. When the price is right, everything will happen. And I suppose if you're an economist, that's perhaps the appropriate way to look at it. I tend to think it's a bit simplistic, but because the rest of us who are actually going to do that have to figure out exactly what it is to do, quite apart from what the cost of it is. You know,
sure.
First is the doability of it, and then there's the cost of it.
Right.
And we ultimately have to deal with that fact of the matter, because when you go to mass production of anything, that's what you ultimately aim for, is an economic application. And that's the whole thing about the whole new energy frontier, as you mentioned, is that you do the R and then you do the D. And when you get through doing the D, you better have something that's reliable and usable by the man on the street.
Well, that's where the marketing manager comes in and has a quality control department to take care of that.
Yes.
You know, he takes it away from the R&D department and then puts it into the production or manufacturing area that will retool the whole thing, probably.
Yes, right, right. Yeah.
Prototype to finished consumer model.
Yeah, right, yeah. Well, I guess the things we've covered so far are sort of the interim technologies that can come into play, and, you know, the state of the situation with oil and what it's doing to the environment, and what coal fusion can perhaps do for us, and the others, such as wind.
Yeah, and even
solar. And nuclear.
I mean, a solar heat panel is one of the simplest technologies that anyone can put $100 into making. And I did it on a home that I owned in Buffalo, New York, years ago.
Uh-huh.
And it's amazing the amount of heat that you can generate during a cold season just from sunlight.
Yeah.
And you just drill two holes in a wall or your roof, and you've got a plexiglass double layered window, you know, mm-hmm. 8 feet, 4x8 panel.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you got heat flowing through it.
Yeah, yeah, so right.
Free energy.
Yeah, and there have been a number of ingenious ways of doing that that I've seen.
Yeah, we sell the plans. Actually, we sell a complete New York State kit that tells you exactly how to build it and install it yourself to get free.
So an individual with reasonable dexterity could do this themselves, is that right?
That's right. It's about a $100 investment. And then you get the free heat from that size 4x8 panel. And you can, of course, double it or triple it depending
right.
on how much space you have that's exposed to the sun during the winter months.
Well, that's interesting, because that certainly ought to be cost effective. One of the arguments in the past about solar was that the initial investment caused too long a payback time.
With the solar electricity, that's true. When we're talking about silicon solar cells, then you need the battery backup or the alternator to go back into the grid.
Right.
Of course, yeah, it's more expensive.
Yeah. Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. One other one that we didn't mention, and I wanted to ask you what you know of the status of this, where we are with it, is the liquefaction of coal or gasification of coal. Is that? Do you know what the progress is in that area right now?
Actually, I don't, because I try to stay away from those conventional conversion technologies.
Yeah.
And really, that's something that the Reagan administration put an end to back in the around the 1970s, I believe, or right
yeah.
around 1980. We saw a decrease in the Synfuel program. There was a $1 billion investment at that time.
Yes. Well, of course, I mean, you know, obviously the problem with liquefying coal is that you you know, the environmental issue is not helped at all with
right.
that.
Right, that's the point. And also it's fraught with a lot of abuse and scandals nowadays.
Yeah.
The stories I read in Time magazine about the liquefaction syn fuel program is not going anywhere purposely because they know a loophole exists tax-wise.
I see. Yes.
Well, and even the biodiesel, if you want to really get down to it, various biodiesel technologies suffer from consuming fossil fuels to make something that's environmentally friendly.
Yeah, I think there are real, you know, ethanol, I really wonder, I mean, I can see the politically favorable reasons for it, but I can't see the energy favorable reasons for it because I don't really think you're going to get any return there. Although, you know, if the price is high enough, then, you know, you go ahead and do something, but nobody is looking forward to $100 a barrel oil. And if that hits us too soon, then it's going to have really, really severe economic impact.
Yeah,
not just here, but
need,
all around the world.
That's right. Then we'll need biodiesel at any cost. So it's worth pursuing that either way.
Yeah.
But the syn fuel program, liquefaction of coal, I really have doubts about, but I'm happy to say I'm not an expert in that area, and I don't profess.
Right. Yeah, I just hadn't heard much about it lately, and I didn't know. Of course, the area that I am particularly keen on is the so-called zero-point energy, vacuum energy, free energy area.
Oh, good. Excellent. That's one of my expertise.
Yeah, right. And I've
actually published a book on it.
Yeah, right. I've been working with Tom Bearden for a number of years in this area. And I've built a little, haven't had time to work with it lately, but built a little demonstrator myself. But mm-hmm. Tom, as you know, Tom has they've been concentrating over in Huntsville more perhaps on the static machine over there, the magnetic machine that they
right.
put together that basically flips the field between two points, and which is fine, you know, and it seems to have a reasonable potential in terms of the amount of energy that can be produced. In other words, it can be built at a scale that will make it economic to use in a lot of different kinds of applications, and that's good. Is that an area that you are particularly working in?
Yes. Yes, actually it is. In fact, my book is called Practical Conversion of Zero-Point Energy, and it's available on Amazon.com and various other Barnes & Noble and Borders.
Okay.
The interesting summary, which is part of a DVD that actually is being sold by the science, there's a commercial DVD producer and distributor that recently has picked it up, and I'll get the name in a second. But the point I'm making in the presentation of the summary of the technologies, really zero-point energy, first of all, to explain, deals with the vacuum fluctuations that are all around us.
Right.
And people may not be aware of this, but recently there was an article on water in the New Scientist magazine, and they explained that the hydrogen bonds that hold water molecules very tenuously together between one oxygen atom and the other hydrogen atoms nearby are actually modulated by zero-point energy.
Oh.
So you find zero-point energy manifesting even in the acceleration of galaxies.
Yes.
So it's really very prevalent. And the interesting problem, though, is trying to harness it. So rather than flipping magnetic fields, although I do agree that the magnetic field itself is probably traceable to zero-point energy, whenever we do find a magnetostatic motor that functions, we can certainly use that theory. But, you know, in nanotechnology, there's plenty of breakthroughs already that have the potential to be developed and marketed. For example, I do have to give credit to Dr. Pinto. Dr. Pinto published his article in PhysRev in 1999 and then obtained three different patents on his Casimir engine.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not be familiar with this application.
I am very familiar with what Hal did. I've known Hal for many years.
No, I'm not talking about Hal Puthoff. I'm talking about Pinto.
Oh, I don't. No, I don't know that one. Okay.
Yeah,
I knew that the engine proposed by Putoff, he's been playing around with for quite a long time, and he's made a convincing case that you can, that there is a way to use Casimir effect economically. I don't know, but this is in the nano level you're talking about.
That's right. That's right. And see, what Pinto's machine does, and it is on a 50 to 100 micron level, really takes advantage of a Casimir force modification by turning on a micro laser.
Uh-huh.
So it's that simple, that you can use these little boundary condition changes. And that's what Tom Bearden likes to talk about.
Yeah.
If you change your boundary conditions quickly, all of a sudden you've got a new availability of energy just because of the shift of the conditions and the controls on the experiment.
Yes, well,
thermodynamically is perfectly sound physics.
Yeah, right. I concluded quite a long time ago that, everything in the past that we have known about electromagnetic phenomena, basically Maxwell's equations are linear, in the form that we use them now,
mm-hmm.
are linear equations. But my conclusion was that if that was true, then you had to come to terms with the conservation laws, which would say that you could not irreversibly extract energy out of any such system.
Right.
However, all bets are off if the system is nonlinear. And I believe that nonlinearity is essential. Now, the theoretical work that I'm most familiar with that's been going on here for some time is particularly by Mendel Sachs and Myron Evans.
Yeah, I used to work with Mendel Sachs. I was a grad student under him.
Yeah, right. And the work they've been doing, in order to get things correct, you wind up with nonlinearity, which is exactly what we need to see. We need to see that nonlinearity. Now, the reason, my conclusion is from the experiments that I've done, my conclusion is that whenever you interfere with either the EM field or the pure magnetic field, you must do it suddenly. It has to be done
right.
Suddenly in order to invoke the nonlinearity. And when you do invoke the nonlinearity, that permits the irreversible release of energy across the vacuum boundary.
Yeah, that's one way of putting it, sure.
Yeah, and it seems... Now, of course, what Tom has run into and what some other people have run into is that, because you hear, as a matter of fact, the Parandev project over in Europe,
Yeah, I'm familiar with his project. I built a $1,000 replica of it to test it out.
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things about that was that they set things up over there about a year and a half ago and were presumably ready to rock and roll with that. But nothing has happened since, and
no, and in fact, that's one of the reasons is exactly what you're talking about. There's no sudden shift of boundary conditions in that experiment.
Yeah, well, it's either that. Maybe you know more about what they're doing there.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that project.
Yeah, right. There are two things here. One thing is it's going to have to be nonlinear, or else you're going to have to deny EM theory as we've known it. So therefore, you have to have a formalism that does recognize the nonlinearity. And so if you do an O3, and I don't want to get off into technical matters here too much because we got a broad audience, but there are certain kinds of group symmetries that they're called in physics
right.
that need to be in place, and what in particular Myron Evans came up with a group symmetry that said, okay, in order to get this group symmetry, the nonlinearity will have to be there. And I said, great, exactly what we're looking for. It may not be exactly correct, but it's getting there, from the theoretical point of view.
Hmm.
And so, therefore, if we say the nonlinearity is inherent in order to get this irreversible energy release, then you're faced with a problem of control. And what has happened with so many of these cases, including in Japan, is that you get the system to run and everything looks fine, and it goes along for a while, perhaps depending on the kind of loads you put on it or whatever the case may be, but it stalls. You know, it stalls. And I'm convinced that the reason for the stalling is because of the failure to control the nonlinear operation of the machines. And I'm pretty sure that in most cases that is a factor in play. It certainly is with what Tom Bearden is doing. So, and the Johnson Motors, as a matter of fact. So, you know, that's one of the issues, at least for magnetic motors. Now, what I'm more concerned about is just simple, plain, rotating magnetic motors.
Yeah, and if you're interviewing me, I'd be happy to respond to some of these.
So I'm just wondering how you. Those issues that I have seen, I'm wondering if you are seeing that, or what do you see being the issues there at this point in time?
Well, the Johnson motor you referred to really also suffers from the same problem. It doesn't have any change of boundary conditions that's sudden.
Yeah.
In fact, we can refer to it as something like a pulsed energy spike.
Right.
And if you do that magnetically or electrically, or with light, as I pointed to in the Casimir engine, Pintos, then you have an instantaneous change of boundary conditions that allow you to then introduce new thermodynamic laws, and the conservation laws then become open instead of closed. So the point we're making, though, and I do need to direct the listeners to the Parendev website so they can check it out for themselves. It's parendev-power.com, and Parendev is spelled P-E-R-E-N-D-E-V. And it's Mike Brady is the inventor we're referring to. And unfortunately, he's got three plastic rotors with permanent magnets installed that as he closes the stator around this rotor, you start to see the rotor move. But the question on everyone's mind, and I found this to be true myself, is that at steady state, when the stator is just sitting there around the rotor, the motor doesn't seem to continue rotating at all. And the Johnson motor had a similar problem, but recently I do have to give credit to Howard Johnson's latest patents, where he actually does have archways that are designed out of nonlinear, very intense Hallback designs of magnets. And so Johnson really does have an innovative technique in propelling a four-wheel cart, say, on a track, which is actually his demonstration, using magnetic permanent magnet arches.
Yeah, that's right. I think he's made significant progress in that area. I believe.
Now,
right.
One of my favorites is the spiral motor, and I don't know if you're familiar with the Curetaco motor from 1979, the Popular Science issue from June 1979.
Not familiar with that one.
Yeah, that was a very famous article. In fact, the Magnetic Power Institute has followed up on that research. Mark Goldis is now proposing a breakthrough in that area, and we've collaborated. I've given him the research improvements I've found, and also he's shared his files with me. The Curetaco, just explained very simply, it uses the magnetic gradient.
Right.
And I'm pausing because magnetic gradient may seem like a complex concept, but it's not. We actually use a gradient in gravity, for example, for hydroelectric power, where you have a difference in altitude that causes water to have a force, and a thermal gradient where there's different temperatures, and electrical gradient where there's a potential difference between two points.
Mm-hmm.
So the magnetic gradient's one we haven't looked at all for developing power. And yet, when you have a very strong magnetic field at one end of a spiral stator and a very weak magnetic field at the other end, the rotor is naturally going to be attracted toward the strong end. And this happens for 90% of the cycle, and then you have to interrupt it so it can continue the cycle.
Right.
And the interruption is something that has perplexed all the researchers for 25 years so far. And I've come up with a couple solid-state versions of interrupting and instantaneously turning on and off magnetic fields through magnetostrictive materials.
Oh, really?
So we're looking forward, and this is directly from the transactions on magnetics from an IEEE journal. In other words, the Japanese have come up with a new technology using magnetostrictive and piezoelectric material together, and you simply need high voltage with no current.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, and the high voltage is very easy to achieve, even with Wagon wires.
Right, right. So you don't use much, hardly any power that way, unless, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The idea is to have a closed system with no power out from outside.
right.
And I believe we're going to see a breakthrough in that very shortly. In fact, the University of New Hampshire professor has just retired and devoted his full time to this project.
Yes.
So I'm happy to say that there's scientists working on it continually to bring all these new developments into play into a prototype that can now be demonstrated.
Yeah. I don't know. I guess, you know, my thinking on that has been that, you know, so what if you have to use external power as long as the net power coming out of the total system is greater than the amount going in?
I wouldn't go with that philosophy anymore. I really have tried to subscribe to that years ago, and I started in this movement in 1980.
Uh-huh.
I'm one of the few scientists in the world who actually proposed that free energy is real. I was a technical consultant to the video "Free Energy Race to Zero Point,"
uh-huh,
that sold thousands of copies so far.
I think I've seen that. Yes.
Yeah, most people have, and it's a good intro to the topic. But when you start to think that you can use external power and then play with your output and input meters, which is what Joe Newman's done and many others have done, even in the cold fusion realm they've done this, you end up with problems, for example, with an experiment that's 130% efficient.
Uh-huh.
Cold fusion suffers from this problem, for example.
Yes.
130% is not enough to guarantee that when you do your conversions of heat to electricity, that the 30% isn't just going to disappear.
Yes.
Or more.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
You need 200-400% efficiency.
Yes, that's true. You certainly do, because any time, once you get the energy, you've got to manipulate it and get it out there, and so you lose efficiency already doing that.
The conversion losses are really a killer.
Yes.
In any system, and I can even cite the transmission of electricity through the United States. So we lose two-thirds of our power through transmission losses.
Yes,
and
that's
conversion
losses. That's right. And again, if we could ever get economic with superconducting materials at something like room temperature, this would be a great help in that particular area, certainly.
Well, also in the wireless transmission of power, I need to give some credit to Tesla here, because I wrote a book on it called "The Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature: Tesla's Science of Energy."
Mm-hmm.
And the book is published by Adventures Unlimited Press, and it's been doing fairly well. And it explains the Teslas through all the contributors to the book, including Dr. James Corum from the University of West Virginia, who really have researched the Wardenclyffe Tower from 1905
mm-hmm.
on Long Island. You may or may not even know there was a 200-foot tower built there.
Was that out? You're not talking about the one out at the Montauk Point, are you?
No, it's a Shoreham estate that's still there. But the point is that with these types of towers with a rounded dome, you can actually produce longitudinal waves that don't diminish as they go around the Earth.
Uh-huh.
That's what Tesla discovered 100 years ago, and yet it's taken scientists like Jim Corum to actually prove that the resonant frequencies of the Earth are actually things you can use to transmit power and not lose power as it's transmitted. That's the most amazing discovery Tesla made.
Yes.
He could send some electricity around the Earth through the Earth ionosphere cavity and receive the pulse back with virtually no diminishment. He estimated 2 or 3% loss in energy.
Uh-huh.
And that's why the Earth ionosphere cavity can literally be used to send electricity without wires.
Yes.
And that
now,
is only
I wasn't aware. I mean, I had read some about Tesla's wireless transmission of energy, but I wasn't aware that he was explaining it as longitudinal waves.
Yes, that's the secret. That literally is the secret, and you'll see it in my book, Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature.
Uh-huh.
And each contributor explains how these longitudinal waves are produced, but see, if you look at how the patents and the Wardenclyffe Tower is designed, it's simply got a Tesla coil at the bottom, and it's pulsing the dome. As the dome charges up, then it releases the charge, just like a Van de Graaff.
Uh-huh, right.
So each of them are spherical waves that are going out, and it's just like a compression wave, a sound wave.
Huh. Well, that's interesting.
And those are really nice, because Tom Bearden loves those things, and they don't behave Maxwellian. They're not like Maxwell's transverse waves.
No, exactly.
And the pointing vector doesn't work.
Right. And Bearden has been saying for a long time that that recognizing and realizing the longitudinal aspect of the EM structure is critically important.
That's right.
Yes,
that's right.
And it is. Yes. Yeah. Yes, it is.
I'll give credit to Tom for really doing some good work in that area.
Yes. Yes. He's been thinking on the edge in that particular area. Some of his stuff I find a little bit difficult, but in terms of plausibility. But anyway, certainly in that area, I think he's been very valuable. And so, generally speaking, would you seem to think that it appears to me that magnetic motors are perhaps the real wave of the future here?
Absolutely, we're seeing several different designs that actually have promise. And what's nice is that there's nonlinear effects with the Roshan experiments. Godin and Roshan actually have been developing and producing very promising designs. And the investment that they've received actually has supported their research stage in resurrecting what people call the Searle motor. John Searle was an illustrious living legend from years ago, that 40 years ago, literally, that talked about the rotating magnetic motors that he produced. But now only today we're starting to understand how they can be built, and so I was contributing to that matching of the inventor and the investor and getting that resurrected.
Yes, right. What kind of, in terms of that as a future technology, obviously, you know, if something like that can be produced on a scale where you could have sufficient power coming out of such a motor to, for example, drive an automobile, to power an automobile.
Sure.
Then obviously you can talk about an extremely widespread application of such technology for virtually all transportation, actually, when you come down to it.
That's right.
Do you see, in some reasonable time frame, do you see magnetic motors evolving to the point where they are compact enough with high enough power output to do something like power an automobile?
Yes, and in fact, we're even trying to work with a flywheel, Bitterly Flywheel Company in California, to marriage the two technologies together.
Uh-huh.
So you'd have a magnetically powered flywheel,
yes.
Which then can actually transfer and store the power. See, many people may not be aware of the fact that flywheels actually are a more efficient and more reliable way of storing energy than batteries are.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I've wondered. I suppose there are some economic reasons, but there are applications of flywheel technology now, though, aren't there?
Yes, they've been used in space and satellites, and in fact, automobiles are one area that has been researched as well. But people often believe, and I just saw it in Popular Science 6 months ago, December issue 2005, where the editor's responding to an interest in flywheels by saying, oh, but there's an insurmountable danger of breakup and the problems of shrapnel.
Yeah.
He's not aware of Bitterly's invention that's been on the market for years of using high tensile strength fiber.
Right.
And so when it breaks up, it's just a ball of yarn. There's no intent shrapnel anywhere. So this is public education that needs to be done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. See, it just seems to me I heard some years ago, I thought I remembered somebody applying one to a bus, like a city bus or something like that. They were experimenting with using a flywheel there to make them more efficient, although they were gasoline-driven by and large. But in terms of the development horizon for magnetic motors, what do you see in terms of the period of time before we can have an actual production capability with serious return in terms of energy output for the economy?
Well, the research stage has actually been in the kilowatt range already. So when we look ahead at magnetostatic motors, and I tend to call them magnetostatic because I want to emphasize that they really are just permanent magnets by themselves,
yep.
Even though they might be other permanent magnet motors out there that have to be plugged into the electrical grid. So magnetostatic motors really have about a 10-year development time. That's what we would give it. And during that time, we're going to start to see news and journal articles and media broadcasts that will really start to get the investment community activated in this realm.
I think that that's extremely important because, you know, what happens with new technologies is that once a significant investment is committed to a technology, it becomes, among other things, politically very difficult to override it. For example, if we said, we'll make a big investment in coal gasification or solar or wind or whatever,
right?
And then let's say the power companies make a big financial commitment to that, it tends to squeeze out other new promising technologies, and that's one of the reasons why I think that moving forward with the magnetic technology is should be done as quickly as possible. You know, at this point in time, it seems to me that politically there is doesn't seem to be any awareness of it. Is that your general feeling?
Yes, that tends to be the biggest problem. And I would suggest people can visit our website, integrityresearchinstitute.org, and get acquainted with the magnetic motors. We offer a report on permanent magnet motors, and we also have various other emerging energy technology reports and books. So that then they can start to become aware of where their investment capital can go.
Yes, right,
they have,
right.
High risk, high payback type investments.
But exactly. Yeah, right. I mean, I think that most, you know, all at this point in time, obviously it would have to be regarded in the investment community as, I suppose, high risk. But the return is, you know, almost unimaginable return on this. So,
And I talk to investors right now who are interested in making up mutual funds of distributed investments like this.
Yes.
That have some that are very conventional, hydrogen and so forth and solar, and then some that are high risk and more emerging technologies that
right.
are less certain. I don't know if you're aware of, just to throw this in as something that's kind of an intriguing development, are you aware of the wave power breakthroughs that both the UK and Rockwell Scientific have developed?
I haven't heard anything about that recently.
We just reported in the Future Energy e-news, which is a free service we offer monthly. Anyone can go to our website and sign up on our free newsletter, and it gets emailed to your inbox every month. And we report on two stories that appeared both in the press in March. And one, I have it in front of me so I can read it off. It's the New and Renewable Energy Center in the UK. Ed Spooner has come up with, and picture this, just a cylinder with static magnets, and the armature is a moving series of cylindrical magnets that move very closely to the static magnets.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden when they jerk or they snap, that's when the pulse of electricity comes out.
Uh-huh.
And they just simply attach the cylinder to a buoy, and the buoy goes up and down with the waves, and all of a sudden you get free electricity.
Yes. That's a version that I had not heard about. That's very interesting.
And Rockwell Scientific did almost the same kind of thing, but a horizontal design using a supercapacitor for storing the electricity.
Yes.
And it's designed to be hermetically sealed, and it just uses Faraday's law, just like the flashlights.
I would shake them
to light them up. It's the same type of design.
Yeah, I would imagine it would be highly efficient, too, wouldn't it?
Yes. Low power, though, but certainly highly efficient.
Right.
When the waves keep moving, you get free electricity.
Yes. There are a lot of clever things like that that are out there that we're just not aware of. And they don't get the political press, you know, and I want to encourage the listeners to Eva's show to be sure to visit your website, which I certainly plan to do.
Let me throw out another one that's very conventional but also very exciting. There's a website called angels-nest.org. Angelsnest.org with a hyphen in between.
Okay.
And Victoria Peters is an actress in California who's married to the scientist who helped develop this. And what she's showing is a Darius rotor windmill attached to their hydrogen electrolysis station that produces hydrogen for their stretch limo.
Really?
Yeah, and that's what their poster shows. This is how I fuel my car. And you can get a free poster just by going to their website
now that,
and
sending
an email.
Yeah, that's certainly, now that's one way that hydrogen fuel makes sense, because otherwise the cost of it is too high.
You took the words out of my mouth.
Yes, that's right. Well, that's interesting. So, it's really encouraging to see all the different things that are coming along here. And
yeah, the people are getting resourceful, you know.
Yeah, right. That's right. When the price gets right, they will. And I think, you know, in the longer term, the political payoff, not just the environment, but I think that if we can get true free energy, and you could start to power places like Africa,
sure.
and the interior of China and places like this,
yep.
to raise their economic well-being, I think we could be seeing the end of war, because war, you know, I think is more economic than anything else.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I really try to make that political pitch each time I give the presentation on future energy. In fact, you know, there's a graph in my book, Harnessing the Wheelwork of Nature, on page 172, and it actually shows the decrease in the infant mortality rate with the kilowatt per hour per capita per year.
Oh, really? Interesting.
And I really respect that graph a lot, because it shows the USA way down, of course, in the infant mortality rate, and way up in the kilowatt hour per capita. And of course, India is at the opposite end.
Right, right. Oh,
so,
that's an interesting
correlation.
You
made a very good point there.
Oh, yeah. I've never seen that correlation before. It certainly makes sense, doesn't it? Yeah.
Sure. And this is exactly the pitch for the installation of zero-point energy inventions and being literally donated to the third world.
Yes.
Africa could be, you know, free of the strife and the warfare when all of a sudden people have the ability to meet their basic needs.
That's right, yeah. And that's one of the visions I know that I've had, and I know many, many other people have too, that if you had a portable capability that you could put out in the middle of the jungle so that people would have light and run their sewing machines, you'd change their life immensely.
I believe that's our destiny. We can't get off the planet without it.
I agree. Yes.
And in fact, I might as well mention there's another technology that I'm really hot on the trail of, and we'll be publishing more on the topic, including my new book, Zero Point Energy Fuel of the Future, that'll be out probably by the end of the year, and that is rectifiers. Molecular-style rectifiers, the size of a molecule, are now actually being produced. And what's interesting is that some of them are compatible with the rectification of zero-point non-thermal noise. And what they're trying to do, though, is suppress the noise.
Good, yeah.
But they're not doing the right thing. In other words, all I need to do is contact the scientist and start to aim them in the right direction of amplifying the noise.
Right.
Using that rectified electrons that are being really forced across the barrier in one direction because of the vacuum fluctuations.
Yes.
To literally power, just like there's a Brown patent that actually shows this technology being used. And, you know, many of these molecular rectifiers self-assemble into arrays.
Uh-huh.
For example, there's one patent, it's 3890161. And Mr. Brown describes in the metal-to-metal diodes that are arranged on a two-dimensional grid the fact that each one produces a small amount of energy, but the whole grid produces up to a megawatt.
Oh, that's very, very interesting. Well, I know we're about to run out of time here, Tom, and I wanted to mention that your books, are they referenced or referred to on your website?
Of course.
Yeah, good, because I wanted the listeners here to be sure, as I certainly will, to visit your website and follow up with your new book.
And you can do a Google on my name, too. Vallone is the last name, V as in Victor, V-A-L-O-N-E.
Right.
Vallone, and you'll get thousands of hits and then find all the books you want.
Well, this is certainly, Tom, certainly has been informative, and I know that Eva's listeners are keenly interested in this area, certainly as I am. And so we have really enjoyed this, and we're looking forward to visiting your website and being in touch with you in the future.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.